Good evening. Trump denied he's ordered his supporters to interfere in the election, but refuses to condemn white supremacy. Are the Proud Boys a white gang of drunken hooligans or a real threat to democracy? And Greg Palast says vote early and in person if you can. With these and other stories, I'm Paul D'Arienzo with the WBAI News for Thursday, October 1st, 2020. The Trump campaign rejected calls to make changes to the rules of the next two debates with Democratic challenger Joe Biden. The first matchup was marred by constant interruptions and outbursts, mostly by Trump. The Presidential Debates Commission said it would adopt changes to allow for a more orderly discussion with the next debate scheduled for October 15th in Miami. In a tweet Thursday, Trump asked, "Why should I allow the Debates Commission to change the rules for the second and third debates when I easily won the last time?" Outside the White House, the president reiterated his belief, presented without evidence, the election would be a fraud.
They found him in creeks. They found some with the name Trump, just happened to have the name Trump just the other day in a waste paper basket. They're being sent all over the place. They sent two in a Democrat area. They sent out 1,000 ballots. Everybody got two ballots. This is going to be a fraud like you've never seen.
Trump was also asked about his statement during the debate, apparently directed at the right-wing Proud Boys. When asked by Biden if he would denounce the violent and extremist group, Trump said that the group should stand back and stand by instead. Today, Trump denied he knew who the Proud Boys were, despite being founded by Davin McGinnis, one of his earliest and most vocal supporters.
I don't know who the Proud Boys are. I mean, you'll have to give me a definition because I really don't know who they are. I can only say they have to stand down, let law enforcement do their work. Just stand by. Look, law enforcement will do their work. They're going to stand down. They have to stand down. Everybody, they have to stand, whatever group you're talking about, let law enforcement do the work.
This afternoon, White House Press Secretary Kayleigh McEnany got into a tense exchange with reporters when she insisted Trump has denounced white supremacists in the past.
The president has done quite a bit to combat this threat. First of all, last week, he also, in addition to saying he wants to prosecute the KKK as domestic terrorists, he said that lynching should be a national hate crime. Again, I think there's no stronger signal that you can send than advocating for the execution of a white supremacist the first time there's been a federal execution in 17 years. He's been unmistakable.
Is different than actually doing it.
He's continually condemned it, and it is really
his record on this. He has condemned it. He's equivocated at times. He said he didn't want to acknowledge it or address it. His record is very mixed on this issue.
His record is not mixed in the slightest. And when you go back in history, you can see that
history right here.
When you go back in history, you can see that Jesse Jackson has praised the president as someone who served underserved communities. This president with Mar-a-Lago, it was the first Palm Beach club open to African Americans and Jews. And in fact,
he has not been consistent on the issue of white supremacy. So I'm asking you, what has this White House done to combat what the FBI says is one of the deadliest threats in this country?
We're not having a debate on a case.
You're saying that he condemns it. I have his record right here.
You need to let me finish.
His record
is quite funny that the media goes haywire about interrupting in debates and then chooses to pursue that very same tactic themselves. This is a White House briefing. You ask a question and you give me time to answer. Yes.
Trump famously said there were good people on both sides of a protest in Charlottesville, Virginia in the summer of 2017, where Proud Boys and others marched with tiki torches and chanted, "Jews will not replace us." Later, an anti-fascist protester was killed. The founder of the Proud Boys is Gavin McGinnis. He was a co-founder of Vice News. McGinnis says the Proud Boys are just a drinking group that espouses extreme violence. A tape of some of his more incendiary statements.
"We will kill you. That's the Proud Boys in a nutshell. We will kill you. We look nice. We seem soft. We have boys in our name. But like Bill the Butcher and the Bowery Boys, we will assassinate you."
"Fighting solves everything. We need more violence from the Trump people. Trump supporters choke Djokovic windpipe.
I'm disappointed in Trump supporters for not punching."
Statements by Proud Boys founder Gavin McGinnis recorded from his podcast. Senior correspondent for The Intercept is Robert Mackey. His article, "Neo-Fascist Proud Boys Exult Over Trump Telling Them to Stand By, Not Stand Down," is available at TheIntercept.com. He says the Proud Boys exult over the use of violence, and left-wingers are their main target.
Gavin McInnes is a Canadian sort of media entrepreneur. He was one of the co-founders of Vice Magazine and then Vice Media. He separated from the company in 2008. He has extremely right-wing conservative views. And conservative is not really the right word. I would say radical right-wing views. Describes himself as a Western chauvinist. He and the group, which he now doesn't have a leadership role in anymore. He's kind of stepped back, but he's obviously their figurehead. He and the group deny that they're white supremacists, but they do seem to make an awful lot of an effort to go to racial justice protests and fight with protesters who are opposing racism. So you can make of that what you will. You know, no matter what they say about the idea that they're opposing left-wing violence, what we see here is a sort of physical confrontations being elevated as a point of the group. It's really a fighting club. I think it has more in common. My family's from Northern Ireland. It has more in common with the sort of sectarian outlook of groups that you see in Europe or in where there's nationalist conflicts. But it also has a lot in common, I think, with soccer hooligans. It's kind of what they call in Europe a firm, a group of guys who like to get together and get drunk and then beat up their perceived enemies. And in this case, their enemies are people from the left.
How did they get hooked up with Donald Trump?
They embraced Trump as a similar troll in real life. And McInnes, when he was watching on his new streaming program, watching the debate the other night, he was sitting in a, you know, a Trump T-shirt, drinking, reacting with glee when the president was asked to condemn his group specifically and then made this bizarre statement where he told them to stand by, whatever that means. It's unclear to me really whether Trump was just waffling or issuing some sort of direct command, but they all took it as a command. And the next day, when Trump was asked what that was all about, he claimed that he didn't even know who the Proud Boys were, and asked the reporters to give him a definition. And this is the sort of thing that we've seen him do before. After Charlottesville, he made comments saying that there were very fine people on both sides when he was referring to neo-Nazis marching with torches and chanting anti-Semitic things and racist things. And then he'll make some brief statement about neo-Nazis are bad, and then his supporters say, oh, he did condemn them. So this is this kind of footsie with the far right.
There's two branches of the fear. One is that the Proud Boys are going to actually intimidate people from voting by being outside of voting polling places. And the other is that they're going to be actually acting as poll watchers and challenging on petty things, the mail-in ballots as they come in, and then getting all aggressive when people tell them to leave or that they can't do that. And both those things, while people have, I think, a real fear of it, they don't seem to fit the model of what you're describing. They wouldn't have that kind of attention span.
Exactly. I think that that's true, that they have a very inflated sense of self-importance, which now Trump has added to. They don't seem to be terribly good at organizing things. They asked for permission from the city of Portland. Most of these far-right Trump supporters don't actually live in the city of Portland, but they like to come into the city to confront the liberal progressive protesters. They asked for a permit for a rally last Saturday for 10,000 people. The city said no. The Proud Boys said they were coming anyway. And something in the region of 200 people showed up. And that passed off without violence. There's definitely a lot of sound and fury here. And it's not clear that it always means that much in reality.
What is the real threat on Election Day from these hooligans? That seems to start a little early in the day for the group of people like that.
I think you're right. I think Election Day is maybe not the problem as much as the days following it. Postmodern version of the Florida 2000 situation is possible. And in that case, you had a bunch of lawyers, including people like John Roberts and Amy Coney Barrett and Brett Kavanaugh, going to Florida and filing complaints and being unruly. But the unruliness of a Brooks Brothers mob compared to these guys is something quite different.
Reporting from the West Coast, Robert Mackey is senior correspondent for The Intercept. His article, Neo-Fascist Proud Boys Exult Over Trump Telling Them to Stand By, Not Stand Down, is available at TheIntercept.com. And the senior researcher for the Southern Poverty Law Center is Cassie Miller. The SPLC has listed the Proud Boys as a hate group. She says the group sees the election as the culmination of their longtime fight with the political left.
They see themselves really as in this kind of pitched long-term political battle against the left. And a lot of that has taken place in the streets, in places like Portland, where they have rallies, and they end up engaging in violent confrontations with counter-protesters. But now they see the election really as an extension of that ongoing battle. They have signaled their intent to go out to polling places, to go out to ballot boxes, and monitor for things that they see as irregular and potentially take action.
They could look at these ballots and use every little call they can to have the ballot thrown out. And then if somebody questions them, becoming violent or aggressive.
The Proud Boys are really listening to President Trump on this. They see themselves as very closely aligned with the president and really doing his bidding. And Trump, since the beginning of the pandemic, has consistently spread disinformation about mail-in voting and raised paranoia that the election is going to be stolen from him, when really we don't have any evidence to suggest this. But the Proud Boys are running with that and saying this could be a potentially contentious situation. And so what they want to do is go out to the polls, to ballot boxes, and that could result in voter intimidation or in harassment and really in voter suppression.
How do they start? Where do they come from? And why have people are talking about them everywhere?
The Proud Boys are a far-right hate group that was formed in 2016 by Gavin McGinnis, who was a far-right media personality. And they claim to be just a men's drinking club. But in reality, it's a group that holds anti-Muslim, anti-immigrant, and extremely misogynistic beliefs. They have spent the last several years going out into progressive cities and holding rallies and engaging in violent confrontations with anti-fascists. This is really all in service of trying to normalize political violence, because they really see aggression and violence as their main tools for dealing with the people that they see as their political enemies. This is a group that has always aligned themselves with President Trump, and they really started as part of this big wave of far-right organizing that came with Trump's candidacy and his presidency. And they've really grown into one of the biggest and most mobilized groups on the far-right today. At the SPLC, we counted 44 different chapters of Proud Boys across the country in 2019.
Any part of the country they're stronger?
They are spread all over the country, but we see them really being most active in the Pacific Northwest and in Portland in particular. And that is because that's a place that's, historically pretty progressive. And they know that if they are on the ground there, they're mobilized there, they have a better chance of engaging in confrontations with people who have opposing political views.
They potentially could kill people.
Yeah, violence is really at the core of who the Proud Boys are. And I think you only need to look at, who they admire. They revere Augusto Pinochet, the Chilean dictator who threw his political enemies from helicopters. They wear T-shirts that say Pinochet did nothing wrong. They've also recently adopted Kyle Rittenhouse as a sort of martyr figure. Rittenhouse was recently charged with murdering two people at a protest in Kenosha. And Rittenhouse is someone that they now refer to as a hero. They've depicted him as a saint in their propaganda, and they're really using him to try to normalize vigilante violence.
Let's talk about Roger Stone for a minute.
The Proud Boys and Roger Stone have a very close relationship. They have for a long time. And the Proud Boys have really tried to make inroads into mainstream politics, especially with the GOP. There are multiple members of the Proud Boys who have run for elected office. And what they want to do is kind of normalize their views and act as kind of a militant arm of the Republican Party. It's difficult being in this field right now because a lot of the things that you saw on the fringe several years ago have moved further into the mainstream. And so it's harder to distinguish between, extremist views and what's more kind of accepted in mainstream politics.
Cassie Miller is senior researcher for the Southern Poverty Law Center. And as nervous Americans look towards what promises to be the most contentious election in recent American history, there's growing fear that Trump's tactic of calling mail-in balloting fraudulent without evidence may either intimidate voters on election day or intimidate ballot counters in the following days, similar to the Brooks Brothers riot. That's when GOP advocates led by Roger Stone forced an end to the count in the Florida presidential election in 2000, allowing George W. Bush to win. But Greg Pallast, author of The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, says the Proud Boys are just one obstacle to a fair vote.
Trump was explicit with a far more dangerous assignment for these boys, which is why they are on standby. He wants them as poll watchers. He said that, not outside intimidating people waiting 3 hours to vote, but inside. Why? Why is he so insistent on 50,000 poll watchers and basically inviting the Proud Boys? The answer is so that they can challenge mail-in ballots. Understand, 1 in 5, 22% of all mail-in ballots never get counted in America, according to MIT, despite what Joe Biden says. Okay. So why? Well, you have millions, and you will have millions of ballots challenged. Signature, postage due, no postmark on the envelope, which is not surprising because the post office does not automatically postmark pre-stamp ballots. We had 141,000 ballots thrown out in 16 because of a challenge to signatures. Now, we don't have 141,000 forgery experts in America who are casting extra votes. This is just a bogus challenge. The Proud Boys will be inside doing two things, challenging the votes, which not only will cut the number of votes counted, but it will slow up the process so it will be impossible to finish the vote count. Trump is correct about one thing. There's no way in hell to count 80 million mail-in ballots in time. It can't be done. It can't be done. I know Joe Biden's guaranteed that your mail-in ballot will be counted. I guess Joe's going to be very busy opening up those ballots and marking them. The Proud Boys' purpose is to gum up the count, and when it gets ugly, to get violent about it and stop the count. This is not new. In 2000, Roger Stone, who is the guiding strategist for the Proud Boys, he led what was called the Brooks Brothers riot in 2000, which stopped the vote in Miami. Therefore, Bush became president because Catherine Harris, the Secretary of State, said, we're out of time. Florida has to certify its votes by November 11th. The point is to stop the count of the votes, particularly in Florida, through violence and intimidation of the vote counters, not the voters.
Greg Palast is author of The Best Democracy Money Can Buy. And you're listening to the news on WBAI New York. I'm Paul DiRienzo. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi held a news conference today where she played out some of the Democrats' strategies for handling an election too close to call on the first night. The Trump and Biden campaigns are preparing to invoke the never-before-used 12th Amendment to the United States Constitution, ratified in 1804 after another bitterly contested election between John Adams and Thomas Jefferson. The amendment throws an election to the House of Representatives if neither candidate gets the requisite number of electoral votes to win the presidency. There, each state, whatever its population, gets just one vote. The president has to get a majority. In the event of a tie in the House, the Speaker of the House becomes temporary president. According to Trump, there are 26 GOP states, but Pelosi says that may change.
Voting by state. California has 53 members of Congress. We have one vote. One state, one vote. Alaska has one member of Congress, one vote. So you see the unfairness of it all, with all due respect to Alaska, Wyoming, North and South Dakota, Montana, et cetera, et cetera. So we have multiple opportunities where we can take down that one vote. And we also have multiple opportunities where we could get to 26 ourselves, but that's not necessary. No majority, then it goes into another range where the speaker becomes the acting, it's complicated after that. But our purpose, because your last question was really the culmination of it, what do you hope to accomplish by this? What we hope to accomplish is to send a very clear message on Election Day to the president. There ain't no light at the tunnel for you in the House of Representatives. It isn't going to work. So don't cause chaos because you think it will lead to a light at the end of the tunnel. Because that light at the end of the tunnel in the House is going to be a train coming right at your plan.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. And in local news, a Rochester printer sent out nearly 100,000 misprinted absentee ballots to voters in Brooklyn, sparking derogatory comments by President Trump, who himself votes absentee. Public advocate Jumani Williams addressed the problem today.
More than 99,400 absentee ballots were mailed to Brooklyn communities. A vendor used by the Board of Elections called Phoenix Graphics made an error on the Brooklyn ballot oath envelopes, meaning that many went to wrong names. If they were signed and sent in to people with mismatching names, they would be invalidated. Phoenix Graphics blew through several fail safes that are normally there and normally help correct this area. Those fail safes, more than one, didn't work. Phoenix is going to be correcting the error and at their own expense. New absentee ballot packages will be mailed this week and will be received very early next week. This is despite what many folks have heard and the governor trying to propose something else. There will be new absentee ballots sent out. They will be received in well enough time for people to cast their vote. We know this was a very serious error, which there should be accountability, and one which demonstrated the need for reforms. And that's something that we're all going to focus on November 4th. What we want to focus on now is making sure that everyone has the ability they need to vote on November 3rd. And we believe that we can get that done by November 3rd. So.
Williams adds voters shouldn't be scared off by the glitch.
I want to assure New Yorkers that while we're aware of the issues and to take precautions, we should know what steps are being taken to protect the vote, that we should not lose faith that our votes are critical and they will be counted.
Public advocate Jumani Williams. But Greg Palast says the only way to be sure your vote is counted is to vote in person and vote early if necessary.
The Democratic Party says, don't worry, mail in your ballot, it's safe. And then the Democratic Party itself challenges your ballot. Gotcha. Okay, fools. I have no problem with people mailing in their ballots. I'll, you know, direct them to therapy because it is a form of insanity. Your vote won't count. Let me make that clear. 22% of all mail-in ballots don't count, and that's in a good year. Okay, so don't mail in your ballot unless you're insane. You do use early voting. Don't despair. Early voting is safe, and get your ballot counted by actually going in physically for early voting.
Greg Palast again. Palast is referring to the recent Democratic primary race where Representative Carolyn Maloney won by a small number of votes after thousands of her absentee ballots were knocked out by technicalities by the Democratic Party itself. And finally, WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange's extradition hearing at the Old Bailey, London, adjourned today. After almost a month of witness testimony and cross-examination, the judge will deliver her judgment in January. Assange, meanwhile, remains at Belmarsh Prison with administrative hearings at the court once a month. Rebecca Miles has been following the proceedings and files this report.
Thursday marked the final day of the hearing at the Old Bailey, London, but was delayed until 3 p.m. as defense and prosecution lawyers wrangled over the details of witness statements left to be read to the court. During the hearing, the judge insisted on written witness statements unless the prosecution or defense wanted to cross-examine a witness on their written evidence. The testimony of criminal defense attorney Professor Emeritus of Duke Law School, Michael Tygar, was read to the court. Tygar said the Watergate scandal showed how access to sources and confidential information can change history. The scandal led to the resignation of President Richard Nixon. Tygar described WikiLeaks as the intelligence agency of the people, and on the subject of whistleblowers, we owe these people a great deal. Tygar also noted that under the Espionage Act, the accused cannot challenge the designation of documents as confidential or introduce evidence about their motives in court. The next statements were from defense solicitor Gareth Pierce, who represented Julian during the time of the Swedish extradition request. In her testimony, she said legally privileged documents had gone missing after Assange was arrested at the Ecuadorian embassy in April 2019. She explained the difficulties Assange had faced in gathering evidence, with locating witnesses and the U.S. government's superseding indictment in July changing some of the charges against him. The defense will have 4 weeks to file their closing arguments, and the prosecution will have 2 weeks to submit their final submission to the court. Judge Vanessa Barrister said she'll deliver her judgment on January the 4th, 2021. Rebecca Miles, WBAI, Pacifica Radio, New York.
And finally, President Donald Trump's administration has announced plans to let only 15,000 refugees resettle in the United States in the 2021 fiscal year that began Thursday, setting another record low in the history of the modern refugee program. The U.S. State Department said late on Wednesday the ceiling reflects the Trump administration's prioritizing of the, quote, safety and well-being of Americans in light of the ongoing COVID-19 epidemic. Trump has taken a hard line towards legal and illegal immigration during his presidency, including slashing refugee admissions every year since taking office in 2017. And that's some of the news for Thursday, October 1st, 2020. The news is produced by Rebecca Miles and Linda Perry. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson. From New York City, I'm Paul DiRienzo for the WBAI News. Thanks for listening.